Okay, so then on this point, he is supremely independent. He does not become changed, even though he is the creator. You know, the Katha Upanishad that is said, you can see the Supreme who stands beyond material piety and impiety, beyond past and future. Please tell him, tell me about him. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10.9.13.16, it is said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead has no beginning and no end, no exterior and no interior, no front and no rear. In other words, he is all-pervading, because he is not under the influence of the element of time. For him, there is no difference between past, present, and future. He exists in his own transcendental form at all times. Being absolute, beyond relativity, he is free from distinctions between cause and effect, although he is the cause and effect of everything. That unlimited person who is beyond the perception of the senses has now appeared as a human child, and Mother Jashoda, considering him her own ordinary child, bound him to the wooden mortar with a rope. When Mother Jashoda was trying to bind the offending child, she saw that the binding rope was short by a distance the width of two fingers. Thus she brought another rope to join to it. The new rope also was short by a measure of two fingers, and when another rope was joined to it, it was still two fingers too short. As many ropes as she joined, all of them failed. The shortness could not be overcome. So all these verses that are showing that he is involved, but at the same time he's independent. So his independence means he never becomes, influenced. Right? We have to remember is that his interaction with the creation, the one being his kindness, but the other element is that he is always very aware of what he's doing, right? Very, very concentrated on the relationship. So the taste of the relationship is what is interesting to them. He's not trying to accomplish something or get some need for himself. Does this make sense? He doesn't have to have an observable result and say, now I am, it makes me complete, right? He doesn't require that. Because he already is everything, so what is it that he requires, right? What would he have to obtain? Therefore, as said, he is cause and effect. So it's like the living entity tries to be the cause to get an effect, but the effect is different from him, but also the cause is someone else. But at least he identifies with the cause, therefore the effect is his. My cause, my effect, right? But Krishna is the cause, so he is the effect, so what is there to gain? Does that make sense? You get an effect because then you'll have something to add to yourself. But Krishna is everything. He is the cause and effect. He's already the result. So it's already him. So there's nothing to add. Right? So for him, it's the tasting of the relationship, tasting of the activity. So through the activity of effecting, effecting something, that then will give a taste. Right, the identity will have a taste, the activity will have a taste, the getting result will have a taste. So for him, it's just tasting the rasa. Does that make sense? But it's not that he is enhanced by getting that, because it's already him in the first place. Does that make sense? Right. And the cause and effect means whatever is there from whatever angle you look at, because we will look at all these different things, like we've discussed about the Sambandhavideya and Prayojana, you know, in the aspect of Sankarshan, Prajumna, Aniruddha, and Vasudeva, is that he is in the position in all of these, right? And so in that position of the different positions of Sambandha, right? Meaning that he is the field of activities, like that, whatever elements are there that can be seen, their relationships, what interaction they can get, what results you'd get, you know, what is the purpose of each thing in that whole equation. All of that then is how you say? All of that then is Krishna, right? So whether you're dealing with the masculine and feminine aspects of it, you're still dealing with Krishna. Because in any way you look at it, Prajumna then, the attraction to that field, the desire to be involved in that field, to perform activities that will get a result of that field, like that. Then the performance of the activity is Vasudeva, and the result gained as this way in Aniruddha, right? So all of these things then are, Krishna is all those things, right? So the idea is that we may look at it from one way, okay, that's Krishna, but then it leaves it out that, well, still, then there's me, you know, as the, okay, Krishna is the Lord here, but I could be the Lord over this side, right? So then you see, it's Krishna that, someone said something? No. Then Krishna in this is every aspect, right? Like, he is the person, you know, in the Gita, he is the yajna itself, the performer of the yajna, the patron of the yajna. He is the yajna itself, he's the implements that are used in the yajna, he is the chant, he is the mantra, right? Why would he say he's the chant and he's the mantra? Right? Because the chanting is the activity, and then it could be any mantra. You know, like singing and then the song. It's like saying, I am singing, I am the song. Because you could say, oh, the singing was so nice. Or you could say, wow, I like that song. You understand? So the chanting and the mantra. The results. So what's left? Right? Nothing that we would have any interest in. Right? So all the different things are called. It means the subject, the object, the verb, the instrument. You know, like that, the how you say, the cause of it, the place that it's being performed, right? All that's Krishna. So what does that leave us? That means that in every activity, from whatever angle you take it, because otherwise, before we're discussing, is that then you have a problem. Okay, well, which is the masculine and feminine aspect? How are they interacting? You know, there's a seeming contradicting, you know, how you say, inconsistency, but it's very consistent. If Krishna is everything, that means he is everything, right? So that means there's always going to be the masculine element and the feminine, because he is non-dual. So whatever it is, it's always going to be that view. So whichever view you take, it's him anyway. It's not that Krishna is only this and not everything else. No, Krishna is everything. So whichever perspective is important to you, you know, or whichever perspective is important for the situation, you're still dealing with Krishna and his energies, and you are the servant of that. So all that leaves for us is to be involved in is the instrument. Right? Because we're not actually the doer, we're not actually who is everything's performed upon, we're not the result, we're actually not the action itself, because that's being performed by the subject. So we can only be an instrument in all this. Does that make sense? No, whatever we do. If it's the chant, right, then that means the person who's chanting is serving the chant. Does that make sense? So whatever it is, if it's the implements are Krishna, then you're serving by using the implements appropriately. You can't just put them down and this, yes, I'm the big ho tree, here are my spoons, I just put them down. You can't, because Krishna is the spoons. So you have to deal properly, you have to respect them. Does this make sense? So in everything that you do, from any angle, Krishna is the Krishna is there. Right? And then there's always the masculine and feminine element that we are then servant of. Right? Does that make sense? We don't become. Does that make sense? So in all aspects, then it is Krishna. So Krishna is, because he is complete, he is not attached. We are the ones that are become attached, and we have the need, and we're trying to get, and all that. But Krishna is not like that, because he already is everything. We aren't. We're 1/10,000th the tip of the hair, so other than us, we're not anything else. So everything else we need, right? But Krishna is everything, so what does he need? So it's just the interaction. Right? Interaction means it increases taste, it increases bliss. Does that make sense? Okay, so then in Ishvapanishad, then it is being brought out here. Another aspect of the Lord's supreme independence is shown in the purport of Sri Ishvapanishad Mantra 12. Quote, the Sanskrit word asambhuti refers to those who have no independent existence. Sambhuti is the absolute personality, personality of Godhead, who is absolutely independent of everything. Oh, Asambhuti. And Sambhuti. So Asambhuti is those who are not independent, and Sambhuti is the absolute personality of Godhead. In the Bhagavad Gita 10:12, the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna states, quote, "Neither the host of demigods, nor the great sages, know my origin or opulence. For in every respect I am the source of the demigods and the sages." Thus Krishna is the origin of the powers delegated to the demigods, great sages and mystics. Although they are endowed with great powers, these powers are limited, and thus it is very difficult for them to know how Krishna himself appears by his own internal potency in the form of a man. Many philosophers and great rishis or mystics try to distinguish the absolute from the relative by their tiny brain power. This can only help them reach the negative conception of the absolute without realizing any positive trace of the absolute. Right? Definition of the absolute by negation is not complete. Such negative definitions lead one to create a concept of one's own. Thus one imagines that the absolute must be formless and without qualities. Such negative qualities are simply the reversals of relative material qualities and are therefore also relative. By conceiving of the absolute in this way, one can at the utmost reach the impersonal effulgence of God, known as Brahman, but one cannot make further progress to Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. Right? Does it make sense? See all the different points that Prabhupada is making here, but using very simple language. Right. So it means Krishna says the demigods and the sages, great sages, can't know him because he is their origin. Because to know something, that means you have to have an opulence, you have to have power. Knowledge is opulence. So the point is to know all things, you have to have all knowledge to do that. But if you only have part of knowledge, how you'll know all knowledge? So therefore the great saints and sages and the demigods can't know Krishna because he is the origin. He is all knowledge. They don't have it. Right? So understanding this, then one is able to have that faith. Right? So it's not a matter of faith. It's a matter of there is a limit to what you can do. There's only so much water you can put in a cup. You know, there's water beyond that, but the cup can only know one glass full of water. That's all. It can't know everything. You can't hold all the water. So it's not a matter of, oh, it's just sentiment. It's a matter of logic. Right? But because there's some point you have to deal with faith, therefore then they'll consider this is the weakness. But the point is they have to have faith in their own intelligence. They have to have faith that by intelligence I can work everything out. That still is faith. It's still a sentiment. So my brain and my mind are so wonderful that they can do whatever it is I desire. But that's a sentiment, because it's not, it's limited. The reality is that the intelligence is limited, the mind is limited. So therefore, how much can you know? How much can you appreciate? How much can you understand? Does that make sense? So they're still sentimentalists. Even though they'll claim, oh, we're so logical, we're not like these, you know, religious sentimentalists who just, you know, with blind faith. No. The point is, but this is blind faith, that they're taking something limited and trying to understand unlimited. You could only do that by faith. Otherwise, why would you try? I have a 10-centimeter ruler, right? And by this, I'm going to measure the universe. You know, saying, how am I going to do this? You know, it's not possible. You need something bigger. Right? So, therefore, it's simply faith. It's the same thing. It's just a matter of, do you want to put your faith in something sublime or faith simply in your own ability? That's the choice. Right? So now, those that have made this choice of putting it in the self, then they can only they're trying to distinguish the absolute from the relative. So, because they can't actually understand the absolute, all they can do is understand what it's not. So by this process of negation, they can understand how God is not the material creation. Right? Because he's beyond. So then, in doing that, then you're going to come up with nothing. Because you negate everything in this world, what's left? right? Nothing. So you're going to have to, because you can't know, you're going to have to come up with your own idea of what Godhead is. So it's speculative. You're going to make it up yourself. Right? So making it up yourself, then you're going to see that it can't be any of the form of this world, so that must mean it's formless. Right? Without any qualities. You understand? That's why in second canto, Prabhupada's making the point that the impersonal concept and the concept of being of Paramatma is are actually concepts of this material world. They're not concepts of the spiritual world. Why are they concepts of the material world? Because the material mind in that can come to these conclusions. Otherwise, how would, as if Krishna's non-dual, how would Paramatma only be Paramatma? It's a manifestation of Krishna's Bhagavan. How would the Brahman just be Brahman? It's a manifestation of Krishna's Bhagavan. It's his effulgence or his localized aspect. So in any case, it would always be in connection with Bhagavan. So Brahman on its own, Paramatma on its own, these are mundane concepts. Does that make sense? Right? They're connected with the spiritual. They have part truth. Therefore, then some little truth is better than no truth at all. So at least they're progressive. But ultimately, at some point, they have to give these attachments up. Right? Because it makes sense to the mind of the intelligence. One has to go beyond to that element of having that faith, having that surrender. Does that make sense? Right? So even like Prabhupada is saying in the Gita, in the introduction, he's saying is that for understanding this treatise, you have to at least theoretically accept that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. Right? If you do that, it all makes sense. So he's even putting that even academically. He's just for the sake of understanding the treatise, view it from that perspective. Then it will make sense. Right? And so intellectually, someone could agree to that. You know, okay, just pretend that, you know, you're, you know, the, how you say, Egyptian emperor, like that. And then, you know, in this situation, what would he feel like? So they can do that as an academic exercise. So you say, as an academic exercise, you accept that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Read the Gita from that perspective. It'll have some meaning. Right? Having done that, because you are in touch with the Supreme, you actually have done that on the request of the Parampara, it actually, the potency is there. What's going to happen? Right? You're going to be influenced by it. You're going to be purified. You're actually going to have some understanding. So then it will be very difficult to go back to one's previous academic position. Because now one has put that faith, even though academically, in the Lord. But it's just the Lord. So the academic intelligence becomes purified. Does that make sense? As long as you keep it separate, then there's a problem. When it's connected, then one is purified. Does that make sense? Yes.
Can you see the scientists in the 10 centimeter room? Is that a misapplication of the Sambandha? That they create the wrong relationship, therefore they, perform wrong activities and get a wrong result?
Yes, you could say is that the scientists, there are sambandhas wrong. It means all of these different varieties of things are sambandhas wrong, because in there is, they see material energy. This material energy then is appreciated by the senses. What information comes in from the senses is relying on the mind and intelligence to deal with. So they're accepting material nature, and there are laws of that. Then there's the observer, though they can't really divine who's doing the observing. Because is it the senses? Or is there something behind the senses? So they can't distinguish that. So they can see material energy. They can see that there is, there is the senses that observe, that are collecting information. They can understand there's some higher laws. But that's the end of their sambandha. So these higher laws are, as close as they get to God. So it's not really very developed, right? And there's a reluctance to go beyond that, right? Unless they're theistic on their own, but that's their own personal determination. But if they're not theistic, then if something points in the direction of theism, they won't really be able to accept it. Does that make sense? Right, so that's a problem. Then, having done that, then the material energy also doesn't come properly into play because it's affected by these laws, but you don't understand that the laws are controlling material nature. You feel that material nature is generating these laws. Right? The senses are generated by the material nature, the sense objects, these laws. So you basically come down to that you know, material energy is God. Right? So technically they're shaktas. So the sambandha is completely off, so they won't actually be able to understand Godhead. They won't be able to understand. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, so such negative qualities are simply the reversal of the mundane, of the relative. So in other words, all they're doing is taking something in the material, in the relative, and whatever is the one side, taking the opposite, you know. So if there's form, then there's no form, you know. If there's affection, there's no affection, or you know, whatever it is like that. There's attachment, there's no attachment. So they're simply taking the opposite of it. So technically, that means they're dealing with the formless, but they don't even know that, right? They're perceiving something there, that there's something special in going beyond, but at the same time, is all they're doing is reversing the mundane, what they're dealing with. So it's, where is this transcendental here at all? Technically not at all. Does that make sense? That's why, even though the impersonalists may be considered transcendentalists, they still is temporary. So anything temporary has to be mundane. Right? Because they don't actually see things as they are. There's still a material concept. Otherwise, how can there just be Brahma? How can there only be the formless? Right? That formless had to come from somewhere. It's a power, it's an energy. Where is the energetic? Right? Does that make sense? So this is then a problem for that. Okay. And so that means by conceiving the Lord, there's at utmost you can get to the Brahman. Most all who see in this way never get that far. So unless someone is very purely following according to the Shastra, with no jealousy, you know, outside of this, they're really purely just understanding the Brahman, then they'll get to the Brahman platform. But that's as far as you can get, like that. One cannot make further progress. So unless one comes in contact with the devotees, unless one comes in contact with the Lord, then you won't be able to go beyond this. Okay? So the four Kumaras, they were situated. But then when they came in contact with the devotees, then they came in contact with the Lord, then they moved beyond. But before that, they weren't. Like that. Okay? So then, in the next sutra, The Lord, author reveals that the Supreme Lord does not increase when He creates the universe. Neither does He become less when He destroys the universe. Right? Because someone may say that He is increasing and decreasing. Because there's always the thing is, if He's expanding, then parts of Him are going out. So He is made up of all the parts. Right? You know, like that, if you love all of mankind, then you love God, or you love whatever it is. There's that kind of philosophy. That God is expanded, therefore all these things are God, therefore if you put them all together, then you have God, so you have to worship, you know, this particular form. So this will become like a Surya, right? It's all the different, you know, whatever that energy, that broad category, you put that together and then it's God. Does that make sense? So it's like that. So for that, then Sutra 9. Because He is perfect and complete, His nature is always unchanged, right? So now, in conclusion, as we see, we're coming to this perfect and complete, because there's 10 sutras for the Lord, right? So it's perfect and complete. So this is the last one in the tattva here. So that means where Ishvapanishad starts with that. Right? Does that make sense? So we can see why Ishvapanishad is considered the conclusion, you know, like that, because it's dealing with this final point. Okay? Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Kaur. In the Ishvapanishad it is said, the personality of Godhead is perfect and complete. Here someone may ask, if the Supreme Personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, then what motivates him to create the material world? Right? So he's perfect and complete, so if he expands it, he contracts it, but he's still the same person. He doesn't change or anything. He doesn't change as a person. Right? So then why would he do this? Right? Then brings us to the next sutra. Compassion is the motive of his actions. He has no other motive, for his every desire is at once fulfilled without any effort on his part. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Compassion is the motive of the Supreme Lord's actions. He has no other motive, for his every desire is at once fulfilled without any effort on his part. However, the conditioned souls act in a different way. They are busily engaged in various activities to attain their desires. Right, so that's, they're training it for themselves. The Lord has nothing to obtain, so his action would simply be compassion, because there's nothing for him to actually obtain, gain from it. Right, you do something for someone, and there's nothing for you in it, it'll be considered compassionate. You're giving money to another person or this or that. What are you gaining? Nothing. They're gaining something. Right? Does that make sense? So the act is the mood of compassion. Right? So if the element of, so if that selflessness is there, then you take it in that quality. If the person is giving in charity so that people appreciate and then therefore respect them as a religious person or all that, then it's not being done out of compassion. Then it's being done out of what benefits he'll get. Does that make sense? But if it's that selfless, so compassion means itself. There's nothing there like that. The Lord is simply doing it out of kindness. Then in the Shruti Shastra it is said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead has no need to act to fulfill his desires, for his every wish is at once fulfilled without his having to act. So whatever he wants, this happens anyway, so he doesn't have to act to fulfill his desires. Right? So therefore he's acting to fulfill the desires of the living entities. Right? That's the compassion. Because for his own, they're automatically fulfilled, because he and the energy are non-different, so whatever he wants, it is him anyway. Right? Because you act to gain something, but he's already what is gainable. Does that make sense? So it's basically speaking, it means we understand that it's something special, but we have to understand is that it's outside of the purview of our functioning. You know what I'm saying? So it's enough to understand that he's not motivated. Does that make sense? Like that. In the Smriti Shastra it is said, There is not anything that the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not attain merely by wishing for it. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 3.7.2.3, Vidura asks the following question. O great Brahmana, since the Supreme Personality of Godhead is complete, is the complete spiritual whole, and is unchangeable, how is it connected with the material modes of nature and their activities? If this is his pastime, how do the activities of the unchangeable take place and exhibit qualities without the modes of nature? Boys are enthusiastic to play with other boys or with various diversions because they are encouraged by desire. But there's no possibility of such desire for the Lord because he is self-satisfied and detached from everything at all times. Maitreya Muni answered in these words, Srimad Bhagavatam 3.7.9. Certain conditioned souls put forward the theory that the Supreme Brahman, or the Personality of Godhead, is overcome by illusion or maya. And at the same time, they maintain that he is unconditioned. This is against all logic. Right? Because they'll say, he's come under. But at the same time, the Brahman is a Brahman. But the point is if he's come under, it means he's come under. And if he's separate, then where's the question of coming under? It doesn't make any sense. So it's his pastime. But then if there's still the Brahman that's not, but if his pastime is conditioning, then how could somebody get free? That means you're independent of this. That means there's two. Right? So that's the problem, is there's it's illogical. You know, as you said before, you're just going on your own and putting things together. It's not a complete philosophy. So none of these are. Just people are very convinced, have very good arguments and stuff like this. But it still doesn't mean that it has any validity. The following commentary is given for this verse. This verse means the idea that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the master of inconceivable transcendental potencies, and the supreme controller of all, can become bewildered by the illusory potency, Maya, is an idea that is against all logic. So he's the master of everything that makes him God, but he can come under his own under illusion. How would that happen? Right? So it can't happen. So his pastimes, therefore, are performed under with different approach. It means his internal potency, because they're fulfilling his desire. We're coming under the external, right? So it's a completely separate topic. In Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.36, it is also said, the Lord, whose activities are always spotless, is the master of the six senses and is fully omnipotent with six opulences. He creates the manifested universes, maintains them, and annihilates them without being in the least affected. He is within every living being and is always independent. In the Taittiriya Upanishad 3.6.1 it is said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is bliss. From his bliss all living entities are born. Because of his bliss they remain alive. Departing this world they attain him, the supreme bliss. This is the end of the chapter 1 of Sri Tattva Sutra. Right, so it's from his happiness. In other words, he's self-satisfied. He wants to expand that. So from that, they are born. They are expanded. Right, they are maintained by this. Right, because we are maintained. We're happy because of what? Because we're coming in contact with the Lord, his qualities. Right, so he appreciates these qualities. Therefore, it's working. No, does this make sense? So it's not that there's something else separately from that. And someone who understands this, who's absorbed in the Lord, then when they leave this body, then they go to the Lord. And then they're within that realm of bliss. Right? So it's that happiness, so that prayojana, developing that love for Krishna, appreciating Krishna in everything, right? Krishna being the object of everything, then it's what actually brings one to the transcendental platform. Right? The others are tools to get there. Always remember Krishna is that ultimate goal. You're always absorbed. Never forget means you're working out all the other things. You're seeing that all the sambandha is right and your abhideya is right and everything like that. It'll get your right result. You know, so all the technicality. Does that make sense? But actually, what's inspiring in all that is the result. The result is love of God. So it means by this happiness, this bliss, Krishna is expanding everything, interacting with everything, and that's where one obtains when one finishes. Right? Does that make sense? So they create the sambandha, the abhideya, and the prayojan. It's all based on Krishna's bliss. Does that make sense? So then in Ishupanishad, then Prabhupada makes a point. The conditioned souls are forced to... Okay, so this is the comment here. The conditioned souls are forced to work hard to fulfill their material desires. And even after such hard work, they are still dependent on the Lord's mercy for obtaining their goals. In Sri Ashupanishad Mantra 8, the Supreme Lord is called, quote, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desires since time immemorial. The Lord is independent in fulfilling his desires, satya sankalpa, but the living entities are dependent upon him. In the purport to Sri Ashupanishad Mantra 8, Srila Prabhupada writes, God is described here as Paribhu, the greatest of all. No one is greater than or equal to him. Other living entities are described here as beggars who ask goods from the Lord. The Lord supplies the things the living entities desire. If the living entities were equal to the Lord in potency, if they were omnipotent and omniscient, there would be no question of their begging from the Lord, even for so-called liberation. Real liberation means going back to Godhead. Liberation as conceived of by an impersonalist is a myth, and begging for sense gratification has to continue eternally unless the beggar comes to his spiritual senses and realizes his constitutional position. Right? So even the one who's liberated is still trying to get something, fulfill his desire. And that's still coming from the Lord. Because he's saying here is that concept of liberation that's being very directly said is a myth. It doesn't exist. It's not like it's a reality, what you could say. Yeah, it's not viable. Is that it's not real. There is Brahman. And there is a Brahman understanding and realization, but it's not as they conceive. It's Krishna's qualities are pervading everywhere. Through his potency, he's pervading everywhere. And through that, then we see the qualities. That's the Brahman platform. But it's still his qualities. He is still, they are still non-different from him. Understanding them, identifying with them, endeavoring for them, realizing them, this is the happiness of the living entity. This is the bliss of the living entity. Right? So it's all being maintained by Krishna. So even if that position is that of the formless being situated in that formlessness, that's still Krishna. That's still that happiness of being freed from material energy, right? But why does it have to be in that form? You know what I'm saying? If there's no form, why do we have to give a form to this situation? I'm free from all material attachment. That's the situation. Why do we have to say, therefore you merge in Brahman? There's an action. But if everything's just one, there's no action. So why do I merge in Brahman? You understand? All I have to do is be free from all material need and desire and endeavor, identification. In other words, all the aspects of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayoshana are removed from the material. I don't have anything. I don't identify with it. I want nothing from it. I make no action. I'm getting no result. I need nothing from it. That's liberation. So why do you have to bring in time and space that you're going to merge into something? You understand? That is their mundane concept of how you obtain this. It's not that it's a real platform. Does this make sense? It just doesn't exist. But they make it up because they're mundane and everything has to have a place, everything has to have a result, everything has to have an action. So they're working on Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, but saying that they're not. It's all one. But if it's all one, why is it there's three? Why is it you say, I identify as Brahman, I make my endeavor, and then having done that, I come to the platform of liberation. So that means I become absorbed in Brahman, and therefore I attain the bliss of Brahman. But what's the need of that? I just become freed, and then it's done. I don't involve myself, therefore I'm not involved. Right? So it's a neutral point. But everything they talk about is action and reaction. So it's a myth. Does that make sense? It doesn't exist. Does that make sense? Right? Okay. By the mercy of the Lord, the liberated devotee is also Satyaka Sankalpa. This is explained in the purport of Srimad Bhagavatam 5.4.5, where Srila Prabhupada describes the symptoms of a Jivan Mukta. Quote, another symptom is apipata, which means that he has no desire other than to engage in the devotional service of Krishna, his dearmost pursuable Lord. A further system is Satyakama, which indicates that all his desires are directed by the Supreme Truth, Krishna. He does not want anything else. He is Satyasankalpa. Whatever he desires is fulfilled by the grace of Krishna. First of all, he does not desire anything for his material benefit. And secondly, if he desires anything at all, he simply desires to serve the Supreme Lord. That desire is fulfilled by the Lord's grace. That is called Satyasankalpa. So he wants to please the Lord then fulfills that. So that's Satyasankalpa. Whatever he desires happens. But it's in connection with the Lord. He's not trying to apply this, whatever he wants, let it apply. Krishna is like that. Whatever he wants, he gets. We, it's whatever's in connection with his want, then it happens. Right? So in other words, Krishna's being pleased, that's Satyasankalpa, right? Whether it's him wanting it or our wanting it. Right? It doesn't come over here. Right? Otherwise, how is it going to be the same? We fulfill ours. But then that's two different things. Where's the connection between his fulfilling and our fulfilling? No, he's fulfilling his desire. We're fulfilling his desire. Does that make sense? That's what's going on. But his fulfilling his desire is his compassion upon the living entities, that he's interacting with the living entities for that relationship. So they're happy. Right? The living entity is happy in this. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, so that then ends this chapter, summary of chapter 1, the nature of Brahman, right? Because we're dealing with the five topics, Upanishadic topics. So the first one is about the Supreme, right? You have to define the Supreme if you're going to, therefore, if you're going to understand the Sambandha Gyan and then how that applies in Abhidaya and Proje, the first thing is you have to understand what's the Supreme, because everything else comes out of that. Right, the Supreme is the beginning, or the Supreme is the end, right? And the Supreme is everything in the middle. Whatever. Krishna is one without a second. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although transcendental to material qualities, he possesses expansive, immense potencies, inconceivable to mundane perception. Innumerable contradictory qualities simultaneously existing in him is nothing uncommon or wonderful. Lord Sri Krishna, whose form is eternal, fully conscious and blissful, is not perceivable by mundane faculties, but can be realized only by transcendental, unalloyed devotional service. He is beyond the influence of time and space. Although transcendental to matter and spirit, he expands through his diverse energies as the cosmic manifestation, consisting of both matter and spirit for his pastimes. He is identical with his transcendental potency. The supremely independent Lord Sri Krishna is never affected by his creation, although he is the cause of all causes. Since he is the complete absolute truth, the cosmic manifestation or annihilation does not change his fullness. Devoid of any material need or desire, he performs his transcendental activities only due to his causeless mercy. Right? So then this establishes Godhead. Right? This is the absolute truth. Incomplete. This is a complete definition of the absolute truth from all angles. Right? Does that make sense? Right? He is one without a second. He's the supreme. He is transcendental to all material qualities, but it's through his qualities that expand everything where and make everything function. Like that. He is fully conscious and that, but he can't be perceived by material consciousness. Like that. He is beyond time and space, though he is through it, through his energies, he actually creates everything by the influence of time and space, but he is beyond that. His potencies are simultaneously different from him, but non-different from him, because the energetic means there has to be energy. Energy means there has to be energetic, so there's a non-difference. Same time as the energy is not the absolute, but at the same time it's non-different from him. So it works as both. And he is completely independent. He is not affected by anything like that. He can expand everything. He's the same. He can contract it. He's the same. It doesn't matter. You'll always. So therefore his interaction with everything is simply due to his compassion. Right. Is that clear? Any questions on this? So then, the nature of the soul and material energy and their relationship to Brahman. Okay. So, mantra 14, then. Okay. Oh, I see. Okay, he's breaking. It means how he's doing it here was that was the Supreme Lord. Now is a discussion of the soul and the Brahman. So that'll be in two parts. So part one will be chapter two, the nature of the soul, and then part two will be the nature of the material energy. Mantra 14. One should know perfectly the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with his temporary demigods, men, and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death, and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it, and in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys this eternal life of bliss and knowledge. This is mantra 14. In the purport of mantra 4, it is stated, perfect knowledge means knowing the Lord in all his features, knowing his potencies, and knowing how these potencies work by his will. The Lord can be known by mental speculation, cannot be known by mental speculation. One should try to learn of the transcendental form of the Lord himself, the supreme source of the Vedas, for the Lord alone has full knowledge of the transcendence. In purport 1, it is stated, the Lord's proprietorship over everything within the universe is confirmed in the 7th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 7.4.5, where para and apara prakriti are discussed. The elements of nature, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego, all belong to the Lord's inferior material energy, apara prakriti, whereas the living being, the organic energy, is the superior energy, para prakriti. Both of these prakritis, or energies, are emanations from the Lord, and ultimately, he is the controller of everything that exists. There is nothing in the universe that does not belong to either the para or the apara prakriti. Therefore, everything is the potency of the Supreme Being. Now remember, para means transcendental, apara means not transcendental. So in the Vedic, para will mean your philosophy and those subjects that deal with transcendence. Apara will be all the other Vedic literatures that are dealing with the material manifestation. How the Lord is involved in the material manifestation, right? But now that para, apara vidya means it's the mundane, it's not the transcendental, but it's still seen in connection with para, with the Lord, right? So you're dealing with Ayurveda, the body and health, but seeing how it's part of creation, how it works according to the Lord's direction, and how it's connected to the Lord, right? Now if you see, take that knowledge, that same knowledge, for example, the Ayurveda, you see the workings of it, but don't see it in connection to the Lord, then it becomes avidya. Right? Does that make sense? So that's therefore that is not dealt with. But here Prabhupada is making the point of the para, because we're practicing here. The para vidya and apara vidya, where you still are connecting apara vidya with the Lord. Because in some interpretation, you could take it that apara vidya is being mundane is avidya. So when you say vidyam cha, means you study knowledge and ignorance side by side, can mean the para vidya and the apara, and therefore, you know, ignorance is already taken care of. So it's already the avidya is the apara vidya, right? Because it's dealing with what's not, seemingly, you're dealing with the illusion. But the devotees are dealing with it in connection to the Lord. So therefore, the apara vidya is still useful on this path of knowledge. Does that make sense? Because in many in the Upanishad context, they won't deal with these other branches of knowledge. There's no need. Because that's avidya. But Krishna is saying you have to know both. Right? So the avidya is avidya only if you don't connect it to the Lord. If you connect it to the Lord, then it's not avidya anymore. Because it's actually, then it's uplifting. It's dynamic. Because uplifting means it connects you to the Lord. Right? If you deal with it not connected to the Lord, then it's pious. It will raise you to the, you know, heavenly planets or some better material facility. Right? Does that make sense? Or the others are dealing with it. They're dealing with sadhana and shankhya and all that. They think they're dealing with transcendence, but actually they're dealing with apara vidya. But because the Lord's not connected to it, it's avidya. Therefore, it's said they're in the darkest of ignorance. Right? Because the other ones at least have faith in something's going on, but these say none of that's there. But they're still dealing with the material energy, so they're in more illusion, actually, than the karmis. Right? Karmis at least materialistic, but in its natural form. Right? But these are very unnatural, that I'm, you know, going to negate everything here. At the same time, I'm still, and say that it's all mundane, like that. At the same time, I'm going to use it. Right? I'm still going to use it. Even my conception of the supreme position is still mundane. right? Because all they have to do is give up interaction, identification, interaction, you know, a desire. So if that's given up, you are liberated. So why do I have to then conceive of more? Right? So they're still dealing with the aparavidya, but without any connection to the Lord, so therefore it's avidya. I mean, it's avidya. Right? The karmis are doing the same, it's avidya. But at least them, you can add the Lord to it, and then it works nice. The other one, where do you add the Lord? Right? Does that make sense? So we'll end here. We'll continue on Thursday. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Prabhupada ki.